Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Are you ready?
Hi, I'm Gregory Porter. You're listening to The Hang.
Watch what happens when the people catch wind of the water hit.
The podcast dedicated to hanging out.
Liquid spirit.
The customers were Stevie Wonder used to come in all the time. Marvin Gaye would come in.
That is crazy. That would blow my mind. And it was just regular for you.
It was pretty incredible to have Stevie Wonder.
It's beautifully simple. We may talk to some people at the beginning of their career. We may talk to living legends.
I was struggling for a long time. Couldn't get a hit. But in a two-month period, those two things changed my life around 180 degrees.
Who's joining me this week? We have the wonderful Don Was.
I was in sixth grade. I had a band called the Saturns. And our first gig, it was at my school Hootin' Inn with the great Moish Last as the headliner. But second on the bill, Chuck Mitchell and Wife.
Okay.
It was, of course, Joni Mitchell. Oh. So that was my first gig.
Damn. Wow. And so here is The Hang. Let's do it. Come on. Welcome. my creative boss. Welcome to The Hang.
It's very nice to be here.
Mr. Don Was, really a pleasure. You know, on The Hang, we talk about life, love, architecture, style, family, whatever comes up, all those things that can that can find their way into music. It's just
it all finds its way in
right
music,
the human condition and then, you know, and above finds its way into the music. So we'll just talk about art foundation. I'm so much into like the soil of us, the underneath, where we the soil in which we came from, and what made Don Was, what made Gregory, what made, you know, the people that we love. So, you know, I don't want to mean to sound like a psychiatrist, but tell me about the beginning.
Well, Rosebud was my sled. And I come from the soil of Detroit, Michigan.
Yeah.
And I grew up there in a really wonderful time, 1950s, 1960s. Mm-hmm. And the city was booming. People were coming from all over the world to find work in the auto plants, right?
Yeah.
And they brought all their cultures with them.
Yeah.
And it was just the liveliest jambalaya of a city you could imagine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not without problems, not without friction, but generally,
yeah,
you know, everyone coexisted. It was a very interesting place. It still is, in the sense that it was a one industry town, right? So my parents didn't work on the assembly line. They were both school teachers, but if you lived in Detroit, you know, you were a teacher, you taught the children of people who were there somehow involved in the auto business.
Yeah.
And if sales were down, workers would get laid off, and then teachers would get laid off, and then barbers would get laid off, and waitresses would get laid off. So in that kind of environment, everyone's in the same boat, and there's not a lot of point in putting on any airs about it. Yeah. Everyone knows. So what it breeds is a no bullshit kind of honest population. And the music kind of reflects that. It's raw and deeply soulful. Yeah. So that, I come out of that.
Wow. Your first like, understanding of music, did your parents, what did they listen to? And how did you pick up an instrument?
Well, you know something? My dad used to be involved in youth fitness programs. Mm-hmm. And there was like a social center that had guitar lessons also in like the late 50s. And he bought a guitar for $5 and took a few lessons. And it wasn't for him. Mm-hmm. So he gave me the guitar. I was maybe in third grade or something like that. Mm-hmm. And he gave me the charts for how to play the chords. And it was definitely for me. And then a couple years later, it was in the middle of like the early 60s folk music revival kind of. Mm-hmm. So, three chords, you're in, man.
Right. And now tell the truth. Tell the truth. Were you doing it for the friendship? Were you doing it for the music and the art? Were you doing it for girls?
For girls, of course, man. Well, at first I was doing it because I couldn't help it.
Yeah.
You know that feeling. Yeah. I couldn't put the thing down.
Yeah.
Hours would fly by and I'd just be seated there. Then I started playing piano. But to the point, when I saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan, mm-hmm. there are a lot of guys my age. I was born in 1952, so we were 12 years old. Mm-hmm. And I think at 12, you're just goofy enough to see all those girls screaming.
Right.
I'm going to do that.
Right.
I need that equalizer. And there are an inordinate number of musicians my age,
yeah, right,
who had the same experience. Because if you were a little bit older, you might say, well, but perhaps I should back it up with a law degree. And if you were 8, you didn't care about the girls screaming.
So, right.
But that, no question that that was a factor.
That was
social equalization.
Uh-huh. And how old were you and where were you when you either formed your first group or joined your first group?
I was in sixth grade. I had a band called the Saturns. And our first gig, I still have the little mimeograph poster. It was at my school hootenanny with the great Moish Last as the headliner. But second on the bill is a local folk singer, a guy who came down from Toronto, Canadian, Chuck Mitchell and Wife.
Okay.
Who's, of course, Joni Mitchell. So that was my first gig.
Damn. Wow. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Wow. And that, what kind of music was that?
That was pre-Beatles.
Uh-huh.
So it was folk music.
Okay.
Kingston Trio, Peter, Paul, and Mary, mm-hmm. If I Had a Hammer.
Mm-hmm. And when you found yourself in your own voice, and you were ready to take it out to a larger audience, what was that? Was that before?
It's hard. If you ask me that way, I'm telling you, I'm 66. I'm still looking for the voice. You know, I'm still trying to refine it down. When we put Was Not Was together when I was in my late 20s, mm-hmm. and I spent my 20s just playing bar gigs in mm-hmm. Detroit. Any kind of work I could find,
yeah.
from jazz groups playing bebop to folk singers. The weirdest gig was with a folk singer named Ted Lucas, and they booked us acoustic guitar, congas, and bass to open for Black Sabbath at the Toledo Sports Arena, and we made it about a minute and a half before. The drummer was bleeding too much from getting hit with bottles.
Wow.
So I did a lot of those things.
Yeah, yeah.
Just any kind of gig, but it was great. I loved it. I remember it as one of the best periods of my life.
Yeah.
Play 5 sets a night and just try to expand your consciousness.
Yeah.
But then we put Was Not Was together in the late, I was in my late 20s when we first started recording stuff, and it was kind of meant to kind of sum up our musical experience in Detroit. On our first single, we had a great jazz trumpeter named Marcus Belgrave, who played with Charles Mingus.
Absolutely.
And Ray Charles.
He was killing.
Yeah. And yeah. Just
a nice man.
Beautiful guy.
Yeah.
And chose to stay in Detroit and teach younger musicians.
Yeah.
Despite being a world-class player. So we had him. We had the guitar player from the MC5, Wayne Kramer. Mm-hmm. We had a couple of guys from Parliament Funkadelic.
Wow.
And that was kind of, it was kind of a, we're trying to, I guess, put all our Detroit roots together in one sound. When I listen to it now, I can hear the seams, but we were looking for a voice that had, it had an R&B groove.
Mm-hmm.
It had improvisational qualities and jazz modes and scales.
Mm-hmm.
And also, that kind of raw rock and roll that I grew up with. Mitch Ryder, MC5, Iggy and the Stooges. And we had varying degrees of success in achieving that in an organic fashion. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, I think when people hear your name, they think of more than one type of music. Just the fact that it's going to be good. Genreless.
Genres are like great for organizing record stores, but I don't think musicians think of genre. You don't sit there and think, I think the next line I'm going to sing an R&B lick, and then I'll put a little country kind of thing. You don't think that.
No.
It's just the stuff comes out of you,
And
you've heard all kinds of music.
Right.
And
an appreciation for all types of music
exactly,
as well.
Yeah. And that in, that informs the musical conversation. So it's like if you went to the library, you know, they have the Dewey Decimal System for organizing the books. It's great for organizing them. Genres are like that too. But I don't know any authors who say, I think I'll write a 600 book. You don't.
Right.
You just, whatever comes out.
Yeah.
So, I've, like I said, because I grew up in that environment where there was everything from polka music to Arabic music to blues and jazz and rock and roll.
Uh-huh.
That's just, I just followed my interest. I just really tried to stay interested and excited and try to do something new all the time.
Yeah.
But I think that if you make, whether you're making a jazz record or a country record or anything, the basic principles are the same.
Yeah.
You're telling a story, right? It's about having a great storyteller and enhancing the telling of the story without inhibiting it.
In your, I feel like now you're talking about being a producer.
Yeah.
And your role as a producer, we'll shift gears into that. We'll talk about maybe some of the if you don't mind, just go with me here. Just talk about some of the names of the people that you've produced.
Well, it's been all kinds. I was struggling for a long time. Couldn't get a hit. I didn't have a hit till I was in my late 30s. I didn't know what I was doing wrong to not have a hit, but in a 2-month period, in I guess it's 87 or 88, in the late 80s, over a summer, I produced half of the album Cosmic Thing for the B-52s, which had the song Love Shack on it, which I produced. And then the month after that, I produced an album called Nick of Time for Bonnie Raitt. And those two things changed my life around 180 degrees.
Mm.
And it's been a really wide range of artists. I've produced all the Rolling Stones records since 1993.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked with Willie Nelson and Chris Christopherson and Waylon Jennings. I produced a Highwayman album with the three of them and Johnny Cash. All kinds of records.
Wow. My producer, Kamau Kenyatta, who's worked with me on a lot of music, he used to talk about the people that would come through Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, after playing the big venues, they would be playing sometimes these small venues or hanging out at small venues.
Yep.
And he saw a lot of great artists. First of all, he saw a lot of great artists that just lived in Detroit.
Yes.
Just on the street, washing cars in the grocery store.
Yep.
And hanging out with them at nightclubs. Uh-huh. A lot of the Motown guys were hanging out at jazz clubs. And he just talked about how the music was social.
Yeah, and, that's, well, of course he was a musician, so that would be his. But It's really true. You know, I used to work in at my high school co-op job. It was at Crazy Jack's in-car stereo place. I sold 8-track tapes. And the customers were, Stevie Wonder used to come in all the time. Marvin Gaye would come in.
That is crazy. This is the thing I'm talking about. It's not music, yeah. But it's just like, that would blow my mind. And it was just regular for you, you know?
It was pretty incredible to have Stevie Wonder. Marvin Gaye. You know, Marvin Gaye lived really close to the store. He used to play touch football out in the street and on Outer Drive.
That's just amazing.
Yeah. I mean, the Motown music, that was hometown music. The kind of pride that people have for, you know, a team that wins the World Series or something.
Yeah.
That was how people in Detroit felt about Motown.
It had
global impact and a lot of pride in that music.
Yeah, as it should. It's shaped the music of around the world. You know, Detroit has shaped the music around the world. That soulful sound, that gospel tinged expression, that playing with the I call it playing with the sacred and profane. My mother. And a lot of the church mothers, God bless them, they used to say, don't play with it. If you play with it, he'll take it away, you know. And she meant, like, if you don't sing for the Lord, you don't sing for God, you know, you're going to have some trouble with your voice. And I used to be so scared of that. Mm-hmm. And to hear Marvin Gaye talk about it, to hear Aretha Franklin talk about it, even, you know, people like Al Green,
talk about this,
you know, you don't want to let your mama down, mm-hmm. but then you realize that there's a place for all of it. And there's a beautiful thing that my mother said to me. I remember riding in her Cadillac. I could barely see over the dashboard. And talking to her about music and singing. And she said, Mom, I want to sing, but I want to sing about love. And she said, baby, God made love. And so it's okay to sing about it. And I remember that.
That's good.
I remember that so. I remember the street here in Bakersfield. Mm-hmm. We were driving up Christmas Tree Lane. And I remember saying, okay, so now my throat or my voice won't bleed when I sing about love. Mm-hmm. I won't get in trouble for singing about love. And she just opened up a little world for me, because there were some mothers in the church who scared me to death. Mm-hmm. You know, after I would sing a little solo, they was like, all right, baby, always use that voice for God. And to this day, even when I sing about the ups and downs of love, mm-hmm. when I sing about a relationship that's gone bad, when I sing about race, when I sing about politics, when I sing about, I still feel like, this is life, and I'm still singing about a higher power, or a belief system, mm-hmm. or love.
I agree with that completely. I had some experiences early on. I was going to the University of Michigan, and I hated it. it's actually a great music school there now, but in 1970 you either played in the symphony orchestra or you weren't in the music program, right?
And you weren't legitimate.
You had to go very legit.
Yeah.
And so I hated it. I moved there because I wanted to play with bands, but the only gig I could get was playing this bowling alley in Ypsilanti, Michigan, doing like Carpenters covers. Nothing against the Carpenters. It's just not what I moved to Ann Arbor to play.
Hey, what's the name of the city again? Ypsilanti?
Ypsilanti.
It just sounds like you don't want to be playing there, really. But
it was an awful gig. The piano never quite worked right. And they kept saying they would fix it. They never did. Finally, the piano player took it apart. And there's a bowling trophy stuck in the... in the harp. Seriously.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah, it was just like a spinet, like an upright piano.
Yeah,
so he
yeah,
took
yeah.
the bottom thing off and pulled a bowling trophy out. And then
wow.
So that was the gig I was doing. I kind of lost my way. I was 19. I had some plans and they weren't, I didn't feel like I was, I felt like I just lost the thread that I was following.
Yeah.
And what I used to do to feel better was I'd go home and I'd put on an album by Wayne Shorter called Speak No Evil.
Yeah.
And I'd listen to it. I'd hear Elvin Jones playing drums and he was a little more aggressive maybe than he needed to be on some of those things. Mm-hmm. And it was great because I could relate to the energy.
Yeah.
I thought, yeah, man, I'm a wild guy like Elvin. And I heard Herbie and he was, even then, man, he knew more about harmony than anyone walking the face of the earth. And I'm cerebral like Herbie.
Right.
But mainly it was Wayne. I wasn't hearing notes and technique or reeds or saxophones. It's conversation. And he was kind of, what I would picture in my mind was what later became video games, which weren't invented in 1970. And I'd see Wayne and myself walking down a street with obstacles coming towards us.
Yeah.
And Wayne was just kind of guiding me around the obstacles.
Wow.
And by the end of side two of speak, you know, I would play side two. By the time I got to the end, I remembered who I was, what I was trying to do. I felt balanced. And I thought, man, you know, like what a great thing to do for people, because life is so crazy. We all get lost. There's yeah. the things we count on. You know, everybody gets, you know, people get fired, people get divorced, you know, your life gets turned upside down. If you can help people understand their complex internal emotional lives through music, which you can.
Yep.
I just thought it was great service. And I think that is a sacred thing.
Yeah. I can't tell you how lucky I feel. Now we're sitting in my library. The British call it a study. I just call it my hang spot. And the squeak that you hear is these antique leather chairs that I found somewhere. And, you know, I'm blessed. Music has, you know, bought me a beautiful house. Mm-hmm. But that's not why I feel lucky. I feel like, and this happened to me when I was a child, I felt like I had something mm-hmm. that nobody could take away. And it was always something that I could pull out and share with other people and make them feel good as well. Mm-hmm. And I felt like that when I was six. And it's been with me my entire life. And with empty pockets or full pockets, it didn't matter. It doesn't mm-hmm. matter. Right. I always felt like I had something that I can offer people. Oftentimes, you know, in those college years and long after college, I had no money. But what people would ask me, so why are you so happy all the time? Well, it was, you know, it was a few things. The way my mother raised me in an optimistic way, but it's also because I felt like I had something that was worth more than money. Mm-hmm. That's how I felt. Mm-hmm. And it also, along with my faith, but it was a shield. I used it as a shield. I used music as a shield against racism, name calling, mm-hmm. any season of difficulty. Mm-hmm. I knew that, well, at least I have music. Mm-hmm. Music is going to get me out of this.
Yeah.
Even the darkest moments of my life, mm-hmm. my mother passing, music was a bright spot for me. Just a couple miles from where we are now on this street, Christmas Tree Lane, we had a cross burned on our front lawn. And I remember my mother was, she didn't need a church building to call a service. Mm-hmm. She had a congregation. She had 8 children. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she called us into the living room and we prayed and we sang. And that the anxiety of that moment, they did that and they threw watermelons through our windows.
Jesus.
The anxiety of that can create for, I was 9.
It's terrifying, man.
9, yeah. 10. Right. That's a terrorist act. But I remember the music giving me levity.
Yeah.
So the power of it should not be underestimated. And the gift, I still call it a gift, mm-hmm. to be able to express emotions. And I love this, what you just said, traversing life, you and Wayne Shorter, traversing mm-hmm. some obstacles, mm-hmm. helping people do that mm-hmm. with a lyric, with the melody riding on your vocal cords or the mm-hmm. strings of your guitar yeah. is such a beautiful and powerful gift. And I feel so lucky.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm with you.
Yeah. Yeah. Very cool. Back to the production idea and bringing out the best that you can in any particular artist mm-hmm. that you're working with. Before you work with an artist, is it something that you, is it a sit down conversation? Is it listening to their music? Is it considering the trends of music and where it's going? Is it, what is, because you've worked with so many different types of music, yeah. how do you approach?
Well, every producer, I think, has a different approach, and I don't think there's any right way or wrong way to do it. There's some producers, a guy like Babyface, who can write the songs, play the instruments, and then the singer can come in and he'll tell you how to phrase it, and he'll make a great record that yeah. touches people and does all the things a great record's supposed to.
Yeah.
So I just don't do that. That's yeah. not what I can do. What I enjoy doing is getting deep inside with an artist and figuring out what it is that they're hearing in abstract form in their head, and then helping them to realize that. That's the most rewarding thing. And at the end of the record, we sit and listen to it together. And if an artist says, wow, that's what I was hearing, but it's even better, then it's a smash, man. You know, if it sells, it sells. If it doesn't sell, it doesn't sell. But that's what I'm trying to do, is help people unlock the thing that's inside of them.
Yeah.
And I'm a real believer that if you follow trends, you're going to be in trouble. You're never going to be on time.
Mm-hmm.
And that the best thing you can do is be yourself. So the thing that makes an artist different from everybody else is their great strength. So I'm a great believer in playing up the strength. You know, Nick of Time by Bonnie Raitt, that's a good example, man. You couldn't have been less fashionable or trendy in the late 80s than that album was. That was a time of like all these bands like Human League and Flock of Seagulls who were doing these sequenced synthesizer records. And here's a woman closing in on 40 playing traditional blues and just singing like she sings, you know. At the time we started talking about making a record, she couldn't even get a record deal. And it took an odd set of circumstances and some people who were powerful enough to buck the trends to give her a shot with Nick of Time. I remember while we were making the record, the A&R guy came in and he said, "You got a tux?" I said, "Of course I don't have a tux. What for?" He said, "You're going to need one for the Grammys." And I kind of wanted to strangle him. I was like, you know, if you like the record, just say you dig it, you know, but right. don't come in here with all this, that hyperbole.
Right,
shit.
right.
But he proved to be prescient. And who would have known that it would strike a nerve like that? She made a very brave record. I mean, most women who were in rock and roll at that time were under a lot of pressure to pretend that they were still 18 and project a youthful, feminine attitude. And she wrote, you know, that song Nick of Time, which is about turning 40 and time passing and coming to terms with that. That was as un rock and roll a topic as you could possibly go into. Mm. And the whole attitude of the thing was about honesty and equality in relationships, really, mm-hmm. you know, and just not being willing to be pushed around or to accept bullshit.
Yeah.
Brave record.
Yeah.
The audience is related. That's, you know, no one could have seen that coming.
That's so dope, man.
So, doesn't always work quite like that.
Right. There's a, you know, for that one, there's 100 that didn't work.
Yeah.
People being honest.
Yeah, but at least I think that's all. You can't really lose making honest music and honest self-expression and telling real stories. And even, you know, even the things that maybe didn't sell, there will still be someone who come up to me in an airport and say, that song you cut, that meant so much to me. I said,
yeah.
You know that song.
Right, right.
So you never know who you're touching.
Isn't that great? I mean, I don't mean to, you know, to draw things back to myself, but then I do. This is my podcast. I say that as a sipping on just a tiny bit of whiskey right here. This idea of the most thing that I'm proud of in my career is that, you know, that I've actually did my own route and said what I wanted to say and kind of stayed organic and you know, authentic to my message. Mm-hmm. And the idea that could, you know, sell hundreds of thousands of records blows me away. That, you know, I'm most happiest about that.
Yeah.
I didn't compromise. Nobody came in and fixed me or made me or changed me.
Right.
And so it's just awesome to hear the story like that about Bonnie Raitt, you know, just smashing it.
Yeah.
Just being her.
Well, you know, I never tell her how to sing. You know, you don't have to tell her how to phrase. She's brilliant. She's one of the great singers of all time, I think.
Yeah.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Don, I do have one question that's just really just like nibbling at me.
Okay.
What are the Stones? They call you every time. Why do they call you to produce their records every time?
I guess you have to ask them. I have no idea. I'm not going to talk them out of it, certainly. They're very loyal guys, you know?
Yeah.
You have to do something really bad to fall out of favor. And they've cultivated an organization. I'm like one of the new guys in the organization after 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
Me and Daryl Jones are the new guys. Like, and I'm not just talking about the band. I mean like the road crew and the guitar techs and the security guys, everything. It's a real nice family that these guys have put together, which I think speaks to their character. Mm-hmm. They're really great guys, man, mm-hmm. you know, and very generous, very open, warm cats, and mm-hmm. the organization reflects that.
Yeah, they probably see that. I know. You know what? Why did I ask the question? I know the answer. It's like, that's a soulful, down, decent dude. I want him in the family. Yeah, that's cool.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, I knew the answer already. So there you go. Hey, guys. You're listening to The Hang. Hit subscribe or follow on your podcast thingamajig of choice to get every episode of The Hang fresh off the presses.
Have we ever really talked about how I got my job at Blue Note Records? All right, can I tell this story?
Tell it.
Okay. I was in LA, I was producing a record, and it wasn't going particularly well. And I was driving to the studio, and I had the local jazz station on, and I heard your song, Illusion. And I didn't know who you were. This was a while ago. That was a new album at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And first, the lyric just leaped out at me. But that's also because of your delivery. But the thing about... You're sweeping up and you see the rug mm-hmm. and in the same breath, man, the rug reminds you of the place in Africa where you bought the rug. And I just thought, what a great way of expressing how, when you're in that frame of mind, everything reminds you of the person you're missing.
Yeah.
And the whole thing about losing your footing,
losing my footing on the slopes of the illusion
Oh, man. So the lyrics were unbelievable, and your vocal was incredible. And it's just you and Chip, right?
Yeah.
Just piano and vocal. And I pulled over. I think it was before the days of Shazam, right? So I couldn't just Shazam. I had to pull over and wait for the record to be back announced. And I remember going to the studio. I won't mention the artist, but I thought, this is just hopeless. We're never going to get to the level that your record was at. And we did the best we could, but we didn't attain that level. But I always used that as a marker of things. About a year and a half later, I was in New York making a record with John Mayer, and we had one night off, and I looked in Village Voice, and there you were. You were appearing at Smoke, and I was so excited. So I just went over there. I wasn't looking for, you know, a producer's job or anything. I was there as a fan. I got there. You did three sets. I think I got there for the first set and stayed for all three. And you did Illusion in the third set. And the next, I just had the best time. I thought it was the best show I'd been to in, I don't know, 15 years.
Wow.
It was just, it was not for business. I was there to fill my soul, and I just drank coffee and ate ribs and had one of the best nights I can remember.
That's awesome.
The next morning, I was having breakfast with an old buddy of mine who I knew as a drummer. He used to play drums for Sheryl Crow and Lloyd Cole and the Commotions. He was married to my assistant from the 90s, and he'd worked his way up from drummer to becoming the president of Capitol Records, a guy named Dan McCarroll. And we were just really talking about how to stay cool under pressure. He was under a lot of heat, and we were talking about abstract things like that. At the end of the breakfast, I said, is Blue Note Records still part of Capitol Records? Because if it is, you really got to listen to this guy that I heard last night, Gregory Porter.
Yeah.
And unbeknownst to me, Bruce Lundvall, who'd run the company so beautifully for 30 years, was ill, and he was going to have to retire. And no one had come along with a vision for how to move the company forward. And they were thinking about closing Blue Note down.
Mm.
And I just happened to walk in with an idea about how to move the label forward on the day that they were discussing it. And he offered me the job right there. But if I hadn't gone to see you that night, it never would have happened. Absolutely never would have happened.
Wow. So Gregory Porter saved Blue Note Records.
I think you can say that.
we can play around and laugh at that idea, but doggone it,
it took about a month for me to actually get hired. And the first day on the job, I called Paul Ewing, your manager, and I said, I told him the story, and I said, so I guess we should do this.
Yeah, that waters my eyes. Yeah, my goodness.
Yeah.
And wow, that's why am I so emotional right now? Not just about but how things happen in the way that it does, in these beautiful ways, you know. And you sign me, and we go into the studio with my guys, whom I had been, you know, working in these little small clubs. You know, one of which you saw is at Smoke, but before that, it was St. Nick's Pub,
mm-hmm.
a black jazz dive bar in Harlem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, wow. I mean, it's exceptional the way things happen. And you feel like it's a greater hand at work, but mm-hmm. At least for me. And for you as well, you know.
Yeah.
It's really for us, even in our friendship, it's just really beautiful.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, really beautiful. But that's music. That's music, isn't it?
Yeah, music did it. Yeah. It did. You know, when you were talking before about the commonality of music, how like blues can impact all kinds of music, that scale, it reminds me of just some research I did years ago into the part of the brain that processes music. Like, why is it there? What's the function of this? And why does music have this incredible communicative power? So neurologists will tell you that the area of the brain that processes music is there for infants to have some pre-language communication, right? So a mother cooing to the baby is the best example of, oh, mm-hmm. look at the baby.
Mm-hmm.
Mothers in all cultures use that interval.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's music, right?
Wow.
And a baby gets that before mm-hmm. you can say, it's okay, relax.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
Now, the thing about the human brain is that we close down 19 of 20 active synapses by the time we're 10 or 12 or something like that, just because we can't function with all that going on. And the choice of which synapses we close down is determined by how much we use them. So the part of the brain that triggers the response to run away from a lion doesn't come up very often, right? But the part of the brain that works the remote control of the TV set, you use that all the time. So those synapses stay open. So once we develop language skills, why is it that we continue to process music? And I think it's because conversational language fails to fully encapsulate the depth of our inner emotional lives. We can't describe it. So mm-hmm. we need art to communicate the things that transcend the power of language.
Wow.
And certain intervals, certain modes, they trigger emotional responses mm-hmm. in all human beings. There's no divide. Everybody's the same. Everybody's brain processes music the same way.
Yeah.
And I think that's why music is popular. The same music is popular all over the world. You know?
Yeah.
And music that seems foreign, like when I worked with Cheb Khaled, who's an amazing singer, Algerian Rye singer, sings in the quarter tones, but those quarter tones are really expressive.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't understand a word he's saying, but right. I know what he's saying.
Right, you know? Right.
Or Coltrane. No words the matter, man. He's telling a story.
Right.
But I think that's the beautiful thing about it.
Mm. I'm okay with the mystery, too.
Yeah.
Of not knowing all that it does,
yeah,
but knowing it does something.
Mm.
I mean, I've been with the great musicians who will ask a question why I chose a certain note,
mm-hmm.
or and I can't answer it. it's sometimes you do something in the studio or on the stage and maybe you hear a playback and you're like, wow, that sounds better than who I am. You understand what I'm saying?
I know exactly.
Or more soulful,
yeah.
Or more grounded, or because it is an emotion. And I'm so okay with not fully defining it. Yes. I'm okay with the mystery that music can be and how it makes you feel and the power of that it is sometimes with an audience. Mm-hmm. That's amazing to me.
It's the magic of it is that's the really mind blowing part is you can really this when the lightning strikes, man, you don't make that happen. You don't control that. That's the magic is the beauty of it. I've been playing a lot more lately. Mm-hmm. I just came off a 5-week tour with Bobby Weir from the Grateful Dead. We got a trio.
Yeah.
And, I'm playing upright bass for 3 hours a night, which is great. And we know the songs.
I mean, that's basically five sets. You're going back to five sets.
I was worried about, in fact, I called John Mayer up, who was, you know, tours also playing Grateful Dead songs with the Dead and Company, which Bob is part of too, right?
Okay.
I said, how do you play that long, man? And he said, oh, you'll see, it flies by. And I just thought, that's impossible. But it really does fly by. Because you have to be engaged the entire time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the whole thing is improvised, really, mm-hmm. you know. And sometimes you fall on your face. And sometimes the whole becomes greater than the sum of the parts, greater than the three people. And that's when it's magical. And then the audience gets engaged in it. And it's like, the coolest roller coaster ride ever. It's such a adrenalized thrill when the thing takes off on its own. Mm. I think that's been really beneficial to me as a record company president,
yeah.
To remember to get out of the office,
yeah.
And remember that it's all about that mystery and magic that you're talking about.
Yeah.
But that's the thing. It's not, don't get too hung up in contracts.
Yeah, yeah.
Any of that other stuff. It's really about bringing those magical moments to the audience.
Mm-hmm.
I was, I was really influenced by you a lot in doing and even choosing to do this tour because I've probably seen you perform more than anyone else on Blue Note over mm-hmm. the years. I'm sure I've been to 25, 30 shows, seen you all over the world.
Yeah.
And every time you do a song, you do it differently. You it's fresh and you're totally present. There's no routine.
Right.
Everything is for real every time you do it, yeah. Which is a very brave thing to do.
Mm.
And so when Bob Weir called me, who's an improviser,
mm-hmm.
and offered me the opportunity to do that night after night, I thought of you.
Wow.
And I thought, I want to do this. I want to do it not just for the music, but I want to work on being fearless,
yeah.
Losing self-consciousness,
yeah.
And being super present.
Yeah.
And it's really something, and it really transcends music. You can take that and apply it to everything in your life.
Yeah,
and that's been the beauty of it, and finding a way. You know, one of the other things we do is we meditate before we play.
Yeah,
the band. But if you focus too much on it, and to keep your mind from drifting, that's as much of a distraction from that meditative state as thinking about the phone calls you have to make.
Mm-hmm.
And the same is true when you're playing. If you can focus on the notes, but that can be as much of a distraction. You know, it's having it going on in the background, but just being there and letting the thing happen. Yeah. That's the mysterious part. It's a work in progress. I mean, you experience it every night.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
Wow. You just have enlightened us on some, you know, there's a lot of conversation about audiences sometimes when we think about them, and as we're trying to sometimes trick them, we're trying to lighten their wallets. We're trying to, but I've never thought the audience was a bunch of fools. Mm-hmm. I respect them, and they know phony. Mm-hmm. They know when you're not there, or you're just giving them something, mm-hmm. but not present. And I never wanted to cheat them. Ever since probably I found out that, you know, the people that are there have made an effort to be there. You know, now, you know, as we do destinational gigs or festivals, or sometimes people are flying across the world. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they've taken off of work. They've made great sacrifices to be there. Okay. Not only that, but you don't know what song or what expression or what about you that they've really invested in. Mm-hmm. And so you want to give them as much as they're giving you. And they're giving a lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
The drive, the time, the hotel, the babysitter, you know, not just monetarily, mm-hmm. not monetarily, it's emotionally as mm-hmm. well.
Yeah.
So I think about it, and I want to put as much effort as they have, and they've invested substantially. But being present in the music, you have to love music and think of it as a gift in order to be the kind of artist that wants to climb into the music and not use the music to polish your ego, but use the music, step inside of the music to make the music great.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a respect for the music.
Yeah.
And, you know, I hope you are that type of artist and influencer. And I hope I can continue to be or try to touch the hem of that garment. But you have given us, you've dropped some gems today and really some beautiful insight into the artistic expression and yourself as well. And thank you. And thank you for being soulful. And thank you for hanging.
Oh, man.
Yeah, it's dope.
It's a real pleasure to be here with you, Jay, man. Thanks for asking me.
Yeah, thank you.
Don't forget, you can listen to The Hang on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or the podcast thingamajig of your choice, and get every episode of The Hang fresh off the presses.
Clap your hands now.
This is Gregory Porter. Come on, bring it in.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.